Wholeness and balanced vibrations, everybody. This is Ebony's Bones. I'm your host, Ebony Johnson, alongside our co-host, Professor AJ Lowe.
Woo, woo!
And tonight we are talking about building a nation within a nation. We have a returning guest with us, Dr. Mutor K. Flood, who inspired me to talk about this because I heard him talking about it, and I reached out to him again and asked him to rejoin us so that we can have this discussion. And Dr. Flood is currently a visiting professor at Bethune-Cookman University, another HBCU. Good evening, Dr. Flood.
Good evening.
How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Great to be back on the show.
Great. I want to, hold on, let me adjust. Professor Lowe's telling me I need to turn some things up in the studio. So people, thank you for y'all watching on Facebook. Can hear better. Thanks so much for being able to return and to the show and have this conversation about building a nation within a nation. So I don't know if you even remember when I actually heard you say that, and I want to say it may have been in our previous show that we had with you earlier in the year, but can you start us out with the foundation of this concept and idea, and not just a concept, I mean, we have them, there are examples of them. When you say, looking at the possibilities, especially for us as Blacks that are in America, African Americans, when we're looking at wanting something different, not liking how policies are made or just structure and government and a lot of things, and we talk about the possibility of building a nation within a nation, what does that actually mean from your standpoint?
Yes, that's a great question, Ebony. So I would start off with saying that the most basic thinking about a nation within a nation would be to at least initially have a strong ethnic community, to see your African Americans as its own ethnic group and have a strong ethnic community, and then build from that towards what would be considered Black or African nationalism. And so Black or African nationalism is a nationalism of liberation and self-determination. So it's premised on the precept that Blacks as a people should not be the subjects of another people, nor should they subject other peoples, and that Black peoples and nations should exercise their full rights to develop and utilize their material, human, and spiritual resources primarily for their own benefit and well-being, and for the benefit and well-being of others, as is due. African nationalists or Black nationalists view their personhood and humanity, their nationality and ethnicity as equal to that of any and all other persons or peoples, that they are not the inferiors of others and are not destined by God or man to exist essentially in forced servitude to others. They are commissioned by their inalienable rights to freedom as human beings, to resist such domination and overthrow it as soon as humanly possible. This is kind of the bedrock credo Black nationalism today, as it kind of manifests in the U.S. and across the diaspora and in the world.
Okay. All right. So that's where you got this idea from. Do you think that this is even obtainable, especially in a place like the United States?
I think it is. I think that due to America's geopolitical, preeminence in the world, that Black Americans have a slight advantage in doing something like this for a couple of reasons. A lot of times, Americans, Black Americans as well, have the belief that America will never end. And if you look at history, you know that nations rise and fall. And so America has, a lot of issues that they're not addressing quickly enough. So we as Black people in America need to be as prepared as possible for when the time comes, and it will come eventually, where America is not a global power. And so some of the issues that I see that are striking to me that maybe America is on its last leg, is that Our infrastructure in America is failing. The life expectancy of whites in America is getting lower. We have an aging population in general, where technological unemployment, where the machines are taking over a lot of the jobs, especially in manufacturing. Manufacturing no longer exists because it's been shipped overseas. And so we moved to a service economy, but now technology can do the work of the service economy as well. So where does that leave the workers? That leaves things of high unemployment, things of that nature. Not only that, but we're also in a gig economy. So people can't even find real jobs with that have benefits, retirement plans. They're doing multiple jobs, not because they're entrepreneurs, but because the economic landscape has changed for the worse. So they're doing DoorDash and Uber instead of having, working 30 years at the plant, in their hometown. But also, one crucial one is that the U.S. dollar. So what the U.S. exports the most is their dollar. They are the world's reserve currency. And so if anything were to happen to America being the world's reserve currency, America would be immediately negatively affected by that to a large extent. Like, let's say China and Russia got together and created their own dollar, and they were able to buy cheap oil from the Arab states with that money or replace America as the world reserve currency, America would take a really, really big hit. And so black people in America need to be mindful that that could happen, and that America's preeminence is not guaranteed.
Dr. Flood, one of the things that inspires me about this concept of a nation, building a nation within a nation, is the ability to create with a new foundation and a new sense of purpose, instead of having a nation that is based on laws that cater first to economics, having a nation that caters first to the well-being of the people. You know, seeing now, as I'm seeing more people having co-ops and community gardens, and, you know, there are all sorts of other economies going on and people coming together in a different way than we ever have before. We're definitely in new territory from my perspective. In addition to when we talked about finances, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, like there is a greater ease at being able to directly exchange money and have more sovereignty. So to me, I already see the ability to be able to live differently from a way that we've ever lived before.
I honestly would hate to rain on y'all's parade, because I really do get down with what you guys are saying. I don't personally think it's obtainable, primarily because we've already seen this happen to a group of people already in the United States. And the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, that was decided in 1831. And there's a certain Floridian historian that I really appreciate that I wish could call in, named Dr. Strobel, because he is well-versed on this. So when I say that, I'm saying that the Cherokee Nation had already sued the United States government, sued Georgia over this situation. They won, and they were still removed, known as the Trail of Tears that happened in the Jacksonian administration, right? Also, African Americans don't have the same type of cohesion that we would like to think that we have, especially the type of cohesion that we saw in the 1950s and the 1960s. All that cohesion ends after the 1990s. So this idea that African Americans are going to come together in some type of solidarity, I really don't see that. Why? Because even now in most black communities, when you see an African-American, a prosperous African-American family, once they achieve a certain economic status, they leave that community to seek a predominantly white community, because this idea of safety and prosperity as far as being in white communities and black communities. They don't, most African Americans see prosperity and safety being in white, being around white Americans, not with black Americans. I'm not saying that I agree with the idea. I'm saying that that is the mindset of African American people in the 21st century.
Dr. Flood, yeah. Go ahead. No, go ahead. I get, for me, I'm more looking into people who want to create something new, not the people who aren't going to do it, because everybody has a choice. I see us, quite honestly, I see us as a tree, and a tree has many different branches, and whatever you choose isn't a threat to what I choose, and what I choose isn't a threat to what you choose. However, just like, you know, people who say different things couldn't be done, people do them. You know, people say something's impossible until somebody proves it possible. And certain conditions coalesce to bring about certain changes at certain times. When I consider my own personal family, there were ideas. I have my older sister, who owner of Vision of Perfection Hair Salon. When we were younger, she would say she wanted all of us to live in the same neighborhood. And, you know, she's like, well, we could have enough space, but we could just live in the same neighborhood. And me and my other siblings was like, I don't know about that, or I don't know if I want to do that. And now, given how things have happened, I could see that a little bit better now. I could see how that would be much more beneficial. At the time, where I was with my experiences in life, et cetera, I was like, okay, no, I want a little bit of space. I don't know if I want that. But now I can see where that could really be beneficial. And so I'm saying that experiences also change our perspective. And there's even I saw an article where there was a number of black people who bought up some land and houses in Atlanta or somewhere like that. And so, you know, there are people that are in the process of building community. Now, I think, you know, when we get to the status of talking about a nation, well, you start somewhere. And so we had Asia Morrison on talking about the Green Line Initiative, and they're building, you know, building up communities, you know, for in the urban cities. And so there are people that are doing this in co-ops and stuff all over. And so I feel that now more than ever, we see the benefit of not only being individuals, but the pure pleasure and joy of being a part of community. But Dr. Flood, I want you to respond.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that Professor Lowe stated that I actually have some agreement with, if we reflect on where black people find themselves currently. So first, when we talked about nationalism, I said, hey, like you just said, it's a first step would be just to have strong ethnic communities. All right. Right now, black people do not have that kind of group cohesion. And there's a lot of inherent problems that predominate in the black community because of oppression and because they've been socialized by a white supremacist power structure that seeks to dominate them in perpetuity. So we would need to develop that and foster that. And so one of the ways that we can do that is with a kind of behavioral change public relations strategy where we change the narrative, we change how we think, and how we operate with each other. And this would happen in tandem with things like investing in certain projects that have a competitive advantage for blacks in, let's say, in certain kinds of businesses where we either consume more or we are the product. So things like hair care products. We could definitely dominate that industry. And we could turn that into something that employs black Americans so that we don't face double-digit unemployment. But the structure of it is also important, too. So I propose that any kind of business that black people start in America should be a cooperatively based, some kind of cooperative economic structure. And if we do it in that kind of way, what we see from the research is that cooperative enterprises, and I'm going to give it a specific term, it's a specific kind of cooperative called a worker self-directed enterprise, where the workers own and control the company itself. So the profits are shared amongst the people in the company. What you see in companies like that, in organizations like that, is that it breeds a higher level of trust, a higher level of group cohesion, a higher level of group efficacy, these kind of intangibles that the Black community doesn't have. Because we don't need to have them, because Black people have been socialized to believe in two things. We've been socialized to believe in individualism, whereas the group that's oppressing us only tells us to believe in that when they actually practice group economics. The second thing is that we have in our communities, we have sort of a laissez-faire capitalist kind of orientation, meaning that we have free trade. There's no restrictions. Anybody can trade anything with anyone. So, you know, Arabs, Indians, Hispanics, they can all come into, you know, our neighborhoods, for lack of a better term, set up shop, siphon the money out of our community and take it to their own communities. Where if we readjust that narrative and we all have more businesses set up in cooperative, worker self-directed fashion, then we can employ more, we can get more money invested in our own community, and we can work towards building a strong ethnic community. And then from there, there are strategies that we should have in place to fortify our communities due to what I said earlier about America's weak points. Again, America is not going to be here forever, so just thinking that, hey, as a blanket response that you don't think Black people can do this, well, we may not have a choice. Demographics are changing, and by 2050, whites will be a minority. So that actually doesn't bode well for us, because when the white population feels threatened, they turn to more open, racist, white supremacist behaviors, which could be very dangerous for Black folks. So we don't really have a choice. We should be collectivizing, galvanizing forces in order to have strong communities, just because of how America is and has always been towards African people.
And with that, if you've just joined us, we are on the phone with Dr. Mutor K. Flood, visiting professor of Bethune-Cookman University. We're talking about building a nation within a nation. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Feel free to give us a call at 816-931-5534. Again, the number is 816-931-5534, and we'll be back after these messages. All right, we're back here on Ebony's Bones. My name is Ebony Johnson, your host, along with Professor A.J. Lowe, talking to Dr. Mutor K. Flood, who is a visiting professor at Bethune-Cookman University. Also, he has his Ph.D. in industrial organizational psychology and is currently writing a book on creating Black power. And so I can imagine this being in alignment with the material perhaps that you are using in that endeavor. But Professor Lowe made a statement over the break, so I'm going to let him go ahead and jump in here.
Yeah, because like I said, Dr. Flood, you know I love you to death, brother. But at the same time, at the same time, I don't believe that this is obtainable. The reason why is because, like I said, other people have tried this. And the one thing that I remind my students when we discuss U.S. history from the Civil War to the present is that, like you said, anytime you see a challenge to what white power is in the United States, you see this rise of conservatism. I would say we are at one of the peaks of American history when it comes to the rise of conservatism. Now, the issue with that is that after the 1970s, going into the 1980s, and definitely the 1990s, the idea of what Black cohesion was ceased to exist. It's not. It doesn't exist anymore. It exists.
Do you think every? I just want to ask this. Sorry for my understanding. Do you think that it's necessary for all black people to agree on this? That didn't even happen in history.
I'm saying that I do not believe, based off of historical interpretation, I don't believe that African Americans will come together even on the same type of level as at the 1950s and the 1960s. And even in the 1950s and 1960s, still all black people didn't agree, but you still had a large part of African Americans having to come together and stick together based off of what white supremacy was in the United States. Now, what happens after the 1970s and 1980s is that the idea or the line of what it is to be white and black, or the line of what white supremacy is, starts to become blurred to where even most African Americans can't see it. I'll give you a perfect example. You talk about African American entrepreneurship. Well, I could, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just going to speak to the African American entrepreneurship that is in Kansas City, Missouri, right? Most successful black entrepreneurs don't even live in the black community, which means that the money that they are acquiring, they are taking to other people's communities and helping build those communities instead of actually building back our own black community. And when they are asked about that or challenged, the idea is, well, I can't live around other black people because of home invasion or because of whatever reason, all these excuses. I mean, you don't see that type of cohesion. Again, HBCUs. You have African Americans. We could actually really do something to support our HBCUs. But from the African Americans that I know personally, I speak to them about sending their kids to HBCUs, and what they tell me is that I don't want my kid going to a party school.
But again, but that's not all people, though. I feel as though you're talking about it as if it's everybody. I also can say I know black people that are adamantly supporting HBCUs.
Right.
So I'm saying no movement has included all people agreeing. Movement has.
But also a fundamental problem with a dear brother, Professor Lowe, is that if you posit that black people cannot galvanize and even just create strong ethnic communities, not let alone a nation within a nation, then what are you left with? Then just give it up. Just walk away. I mean, if you don't think that is even a possibility, then okay. I mean, then you've just given up and lost all hope.
I'm saying that I still live in the black community, and okay, I will continue to live in the black community.
You be an exception to your own rule that you're talking about.
No, what I'm saying is that I see African Americans, especially African Americans that have money, that are prosperous, attempting to. Let's not play
right,
like.
So let me interject there. So and this is why I'm specifically talking about worker self-directed enterprises, which are a specific type of cooperative, because what we don't want is a black capitalism, because black capitalism is sort of a myth. It doesn't really exist, and it's not beneficial to black people, and so what we want to do is foster the kind of group cohesion that you were discussing that we did not have earlier, and so one way to do that is through certain kind of business organizations. And one of the reasons why we should focus on that is because where are you at most of the time? You're mostly at work, right, for 8 or 9 hours a day. And so black people, by and large, go to work for large white corporations. And so they don't see each other as being leaders. They don't have to build trust and motivation to work with each other, and so that kind of individualist mindset becomes the standard. And so if you change the work environment, you can change a lot of the negative personality traits that have been socialized into black people, to where they would want to work with each other, they'll be more motivated, at least as a starting block to create strong ethnic communities. And now, what you talked about with fascism, like Donald Trump, essentially a neo-fascist. The rise of Donald Trump is essentially due to the holes that we see in the American economy. It's putting up a mirror showing the fractures in the American psyche and in the American dream. And that's why a rise of a neo-fascist could come about. And that should be very concerning to black people, because the scapegoat at first, you know, is the illegal immigrants. But what happens if they turn their gaze onto black people? Well, we have a problem. So again, we have to be strong to offset something like that. We have to start getting our stuff together, because they can't be who they are unless we are who we are. Right? So if we change, they have to change. We have to do things differently. We can't do the same thing and expect the same different results, because that would be a version of insanity.
I think, it to your point, Dr. Flood, our state of being and the self-image that we have, if we see ourselves differently, then there's a domino effect that occurs when we have a different perspective of who we think we are. And
yes.
And then you can do a lot of things just based on that inspiration alone. And a great enough vision attracts money and people and circumstances and events to it. We see it happening in a lot of areas, and we're very much a part of that. And for me in particular, I do want to say that I'm not necessarily saying we be in isolation, or, you know, we don't intermingle with anybody else. But I'm saying from the standpoint of coming together in a way that we know how we don't want to live, so how do we want to live? And what do we need to put in place to make our desires come true? I want to give everybody an opportunity again to call in if you want to join in on the conversation. Ronkia Bates is on the other side of the glass to take your call at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. And I just heard the click. I know you did as well. Something must have happened to... Oh, Dr. Flood is calling back. He dropped connection, but he's back with us. Professor Lowe has a statement, and then Dr. Flood will let you rejoin.
Yes. I get what you guys are saying, and I don't want you to think that I'm not for that. I just think that after, number one, the rise of conservatism has always been there. And that's one of the patterns I show in my class, in my history classes, especially after the Civil Wars. Anytime you see a challenge to what America is as far as being a white supremacist country, you see a rise of conservatism. People saying, well, we need to hold on to these values. I get what you guys are saying. What my issue is, or what I've noticed from the history, is that after the crack era, you don't see the same type of cohesion or the willingness for African Americans to even start coming together. I mean, we say that now. We say, okay, yeah, we want to come back. We want to have black unity now. But we were not willing to sacrifice what it's going to take for us to actually create black unity.
And so as a psychologist, what I would say is that, again, you can't create, though. Those conditions are created by our environment. They're created by our educational system, our social system, our media system. You can reverse that, all right? All you need is certain kinds of public relations, as well as small wins, small victories for African people. You need to have positive African-centered propaganda out there. So something like, hey, anybody who gets on the mic in front of the media is talking about, you know, building strong ethnic communities, building worker self-directed enterprises, building trust, building motivation within the black community. You can reverse a lot of those, but with just kind of advertising. But also, if we start to build businesses which can employ our own people in ways that are beneficial to them, well, now you're working with other black people. You have, again, you have bosses who are black people. You have, you're developing trust with black people. You're developing all of those kind of things that you're talking about as negative qualities that we don't have. You have to start somewhere, right? We're not saying tomorrow we're getting the pitchforks and guns and taking over America. We're just saying building strong ethnic communities. Now, further down the line, due to America's, what I believe America is going to collapse, we should be preparing for things like that. But at this particular juncture in time, we just need to get out of the hole. We're deep in the hole. We need to, you know, at least be able to employ our own people, have our own kind of media so we can get the word out about things that are of real value to African people, and have a strong social system where we can develop the kind of qualities that we would need to be able to then in the future foster a strong nation.
Okay, I have a question for both of you guys, for you and for Dr. Flood and you, Ms. Johnson. Question is, where are these black communities? Where would you think that these black communities, or where would you suggest these black communities spring up? Do you think that we should have these black communities in rural areas? Do you think that we should have these black communities in suburban areas? Should they be already existing or prior existing black communities as far as like history? Like, I'm curious on where you guys would consider these black communities. Or can you really have a community without black people living together, which I think is just asinine, just a crazy.
Well, there are plenty of black communities already. Killer Mike and T.I. and different, you know, people in Atlanta that are doing things to buy their blocks back, you know, and buying things in their neighborhoods to strengthen their neighborhoods.
Gotcha.
You also, for me personally, everything starts with you and your family at first.
Okay.
I mean, for many of us, how many people now are starting to have more family conversations about coming together more as a family, and perhaps in some ways that we haven't decided, haven't talked about previously?
My family is, there's only a couple of people in my, most of my, both sides of my family that actually live inside the urban core. Most of my family lives in suburban areas.
Would you be interested in starting with the people who were interested? If are you even interested in this idea, period? Because if you're not, you just not.
Yeah, I mean, no, I would love
it. we could talk about it endlessly, but if you're not interested
in my plan, it's an easy answer for me. You know, you start where there's a concentration of black folks. So most black people in America live in around 12 major cities. You start where the black folks are, and you build from there. That would be my answer for that particular question.
So, I guess what I'm saying, because when I think like a nation inside a nation, or this idea of nation building, like I think like a black, I think of black grocery stores, I think of black schools, I think of all those necessities that African Americans, or that anybody needs in order to thrive, right? But what I'm saying about that, and I'm just using Kansas City as the model, and I'm going to have to bring you here one day, Dr. Flood, so you can see this, because here, where the black people usually, where the black people are concentrated, there you see a conscious effort for these African Americans to flee. Meanwhile, gentrification is pumping strong.
I will also say, Dr. Right. Flood, another perspective of Kansas City, I see community gardens. I see, you know, it's, I mean, we got to tell the different perspectives because that's an actual fact.
Okay, you're right. You do.
There are black-owned community gardens.
Yes.
There are people that are homeschooling. So, I mean, it's, especially as Dr. Flood was talking about our education system, I mean, sometimes you have to take that sovereignty back for yourself and not say we have to build the same exact structure that we see existing. Clearly, this isn't the best structure for us. And so when I see people doing alternative means of grassroots organizations and coming together to help each other, to me, that is building community, and community leads to nation building.
I get that.
Dr. Flood, you can answer that question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where you see.
Yeah, I mean, again, you keep on returning back to the brain drain and black flight. And yeah, those are realities currently. What I'm saying is that if we have a plan and a strategy, we can reverse a lot of those. And so we would start where black people are heavily concentrated. We would create businesses which black people would have a competitive advantage, all right, where they either consume more or, again, they are the product. And then we would have what's called, horizontal industries and vertical industries where we dominate those core niche businesses, and we employ black people in our vicinity in those businesses, having good, high-paying jobs to foster, again, those kind of qualities and personality traits that have been purposely socialized out of us. And that is a way to bridge into a more a flowering of our ethnic communities going forward to a strong nation within the nation. So I know there's problems. I know there's lots of problems. I have a list of problems in the book I'm writing about the development of a nation. But what we're talking about is not that the problems are unsolvable, because they are solvable. We're talking about building, having strategies and plans and solutions to overcome those obstacles, because we need to.
Period. All right, we're going to take our last station break for the hour. You can feel free to give us a call at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. And join in on the conversation if you're just joining us. This is Ebony's Bones. I'm your host, Ebony Johnson, alongside our co-host, Professor A.J. Lowe. And we are talking to Dr. Mutor K. Flood, visiting professor at Bethune-Cookman University. And our topic tonight is about building a nation within a nation. So feel free to give us a call with questions and our comments, and we'll be back after these messages. And we're back here on Ebony's Bones for the last about 17 minutes of the show, and we're talking again to Dr. Mutor K. Flood, visiting professor at Bethune-Cookman University, about building a nation within a nation. Go ahead, Professor Lowe.
I want to go ahead and reiterate my stance. I believe in what you guys are saying. I don't really think it's obtainable, primarily because when I went to this school called the Florida A&M University, you know,
I went there too.
I'm saying that I was introduced to a utopia that I have been trying to recreate ever since I left. So ever since I left, which was like literally 10 years ago, I've been trying to, or thinking that it's possible to recreate this black utopia where African Americans, even though we have issues, we can come together, we can create our own community. But what I'm starting to realize is that I don't think that that's obtainable. I think that I was introduced to a utopia that doesn't really exist outside of situations.
Why can't you start those communities in those black colleges?
What I would say is this. Okay, Koreans, they have ethnic communities. Vietnamese have ethnic communities. White folks have ethnic communities. Cubans have ethnic communities. Why is it that this is something that is completely untenable, undoable for African Americans?
Because African Americans tend to believe that diversity is something that should be championed by African Americans. When I talk to black people, and I'm not just talking about black people in Kansas City, I'm talking about when I talked about African Americans, they talk about how, oh, well, I want to send my kid to a diverse school. And I'm like, well, you know, diversity, what is diversity? Because when I hear diversity, that just means intermingling with whites to most black people. So I'm
right, and so what I'm saying is that becomes the option, because black people aren't stupid. They know that the schools, the public schools, aren't worth, you know, aren't worth it. They're not strong. They're not. They won't build the kind of things that they think their children should leave with once they finish schooling.
But why
so
is that?
They're making prudent decisions in a white supremacist society. So you build the schools. You build the economic, social, and political infrastructure so that black people make different decisions.
Okay.
Ones that are pro-African-centered, pro-nation building.
I want to say to you, though, Dr. Professor Lowe, we also had a person on our show earlier talking about Black Wall Street. That's a whole community that was built and thriving with black people. It was burned and then they rebuilt.
So I'm saying we have a
caller, and I want to get this caller in.
Okay, let's get the caller.
This is Vernon from Kansas. Oh, Vernon, you hung up? So call us back if you want to join in on the conversation.
Let me say this. When we talk about Black Wall Street or Greenwood, as it's known as Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, yes, they did create black prosperity. Yes, it was absolutely destroyed by ideas and people that promote white supremacy. It was rebuilt, but it was not rebuilt to what it was before it got burned down. That's what I think, what I want to go ahead and point out, is that even though they did rebuild, they had so many obstacles put in front of them by those same people that had burned the area down or allowed for the burning of the area.
What is your solution?
What is my solution?
It's a great question.
Oh, see, it's I'm a historian. So all I do is read the tea leaves, which is necessarily history. I do believe that our main solution is cohesion. But I also believe that my solution is, I don't think it's obtainable.
You can create, as an organizational psychologist, you can create those kind of personality traits in black people. And I'm not a historian, but I do read lots of history. And so what you use history for is to learn your mistakes. You don't have to have the same strategies, and nor is the things that I'm working on in the book that I'm writing the same strategies that created the Tulsas and the Rosewoods and the 10 other black cities that that were torn down by white violence, by white mob violence. We don't live in the same kind of overt racist realities. So there's other strategies that can be utilized and that we should utilize, and we should also figure out and strategize ways to counteract when things like white mob violence comes to our door. So there's planning that comes, there's a strategy, we just kind of magically kind of group together and then everything's all going to be all good until white folks get mad. No,
Dr. Fluck,
we learn from history.
Dr. Fluck, can you talk about co-ops? I know someone was telling me about Jackson, Mississippi, which is a black-owned and generated co-op, and they're doing a lot in that area with getting to get from an educational and economic, a well-being standpoint. I had someone who was listening to the show tonight talked about in history, the church community started within the churches, that being possible. But can you talk more about how we start organizing? And I know people are doing it, so I don't even want to act as if there aren't people that are doing this, because they are. Can you talk about some of the co-ops, though?
Yeah, sure. So this is like a kind of a brief history of the black cooperative movement. So what is a cooperative enterprise, colloquially known as a co-op? So the term, cooperative or co-op, it describes a broad range of institutions and enterprises. It has cooperative ownership, cooperative purchasing, cooperative selling, and cooperative labor. These have all been called co-ops. And for centuries, groups of small and medium-sized capitalist enterprises within the same industry have banded together into sales and marketing co-ops to secure higher prices than they would command individually, and just to galvanize and collect resources so that they're stronger than if they were coming to the market individually. And for cooperatives, just to give you some history of it, like in America for black folks, so in 1787, the Free African Society was founded in Philadelphia by Richard Allen and Abisom Jones, both black nationalists. They also started the Second African American Mutual Aid Society, which is a cooperative kind of venture. And you'll see there's a who's who of names in the cooperative movement. So then you go to 1918, and the UNIA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, was founded as a mutual benefit and reform association. So that is also in the cooperative sector. Then you have, in I guess 1927, the Colored Merchants Association. It's a marketing cooperative of independent African-American grocers, founded by the National Negro Business League, which was started by Booker T in 1900 at Tuskegee. Then you have in 1940, Ida B. Wells. And she had cooperative operations on the south side of Chicago. And in 66, you had the Black Panther Party, founded in Oakland, California, that included things like free breakfast and education programs for children, and the provision for free shoes from the Panther's own factory, clothing, food, health care, plumbing, repair, pest control, transportation for the aged. We also have, in the next year, in 67, Fannie Lou Hamer. So the cooperative and more socialistic kind of enterprise setups, you know, are replete in African society, not because we do kind of prefer those kind of setups, but we also had no choice, you know, because of white hegemonic forces. So when we talk about cooperatives in general, you know, a cooperative that I'm suggesting that we build things such as, you know, credit unions. So with cooperative credit unions, we can give, you know, mortgages to local businesses, local Black businesses and residents, and help with the savings of residents and donations to the community. When it comes to a worker co-ops, we can use those wages. Wages could be used to buy goods in stores, mortgage from the credit unions. You know, the dividends would increase residents' assets, and it would be anchored in the community itself. You also could have co-op stores, so you get affordable local produce and supplies. Again, that's anchored in the community, and also housing co-ops. Now you have more home ownership in the community, which reduces brain drain and Black flight and increases those kind of personality traits that would help us build more effective communities.
I have a question, because I was listening to these organizations, and again, let me go ahead and reiterate my stance is that I am absolutely for what you guys are talking about, but I do believe, based off of history, me and my uncle go back and forth with the statement I'm about to make. He tells me to use different words, but when you look at American history, I would say that African Americans have been put into a situation that is similar to the Native Americans. The only difference is that African Americans still have numbers, whereas the Native American population has been forced to dwindle down into nothing. But the term I used when I look at African Americans is conquered. Why do I say that? It's because what happened to the UNIA? What happened to the Black Panther Party for self-defense? Even though I agree those are great examples of co-ops, what happened to those organizations, Dr. Flood?
So what I would say to answer this again is this the 1960s? Is this the 1900s? Is this the 1700s? Knowing history is knowing how not to repeat things that didn't, that ended up not being in the best interest of African people. So we don't have to do exactly the same as what happened before and, again, expect this different results.
Understood.
That's not what we're saying. That's not what anyone's saying in the Black nationalist movement. We're saying, hey, be smarter, be more strategic, and figure things out. The kind of overt racism experience in the 60s, the 40s, the, you know, the 1890s, is not the same as today, you know. So we have different strategies for today, right? And you have to try, because if not, then you're just throwing in the towel. You're leaving yourself ripe and open for when the tides change in America for essentially genocide.
Well, this is my statement, or this is what I want to push back on, is that American racism is an evolving practice. So what I mean by that
Fair
is
enough.
that is that when you start talking about the same racism that was in the 1900s or the late 1800s to the 1900s, the 1960s and 1970s, you're right. That racism is not the model. It's been modified. It's been modified to the point to where most African Americans can't recognize it. And I'll push back in saying that you're right. History shows us how we should not repeat situations that we were already went through. The issue is that most Americans, black or white, don't know American history. We know certain facts. We know trivia.
And that's the job of African educators to teach African people this at African schools.
Well, I will say this, that I went to a black school, and I am currently an instructor, right? And one of the things that frustrates me as far as being a history instructor is that I feel like in some levels or some part that the topic of American history is one that most Americans think they know, but they know very little about. Just like when we talk about African American history, black people think they know about African American history, but it turns out in all reality, we don't know as much as what we think we would like to know. Because I agree with you. If we know better, then we should do better. Like Dr. Bobby Wright said, if you know better, then you should do better. But it's either we don't know better, right? Because we're not doing better. So,
and that's the job. And again, that's the job of educators to make that a reality. It's the job of us to make a reality for a better future for African peoples.
We just
I'm an educator myself, so I understand this, you know, very well.
We just had somebody from the Facebook chime in, Mr. Robert Lee, and he says that He said, no, really, he was just, and actually, that was one of my history instructors who I would credit for even sparking the love for history that I have back in high school that I didn't even recognize. But he says that racism is worse now due to it being hidden. I would have to agree with that, because now you have, and I talked to my nephew, he's starting to understand, but at one point when my nephew was in quote unquote diverse schools, he didn't believe that racism existed.
So what you're telling me is that racism is worse now than abject slavery, abject chattel slavery.
That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that's not what I'm saying. I said racism is evolving.
That's the worst, most virulent form of racism is abject chattel slavery. So you're saying right now,
I would say the worst form of racism.
Worse off than abject chattel slaves?
No, I would say that the worst form of American racism would be American lynch culture. Because at least with chattel slavery, they still weren't killing black people indiscriminately. When you see lynch culture,
they were working them to death.
That is true. I'm not debating that. What I'm saying is that to kill somebody for looking at somebody else, that is beyond ridiculous. And what I'm saying is that racism itself is evolving.
But so is being a slave for your whole life and working you to death so that you die at 35.
That is my example of how racism is evolving. Because you see American lynch culture happen right after American slavery. Once lynch culture was absolutely viewed as unacceptable, you see racism evolve into something else. Well, what racism has evolved...
And that's why we have strategies. So I would say that racism is different, not better. So we have to take what are the strong points in the culture that we live in right now that we can take advantage of? What are the weak points? And build a strategy from that. And as demographics and things shift and change, we need to be flexible enough to change with that.
Dr. Flo, we have like a minute left for the show. Do you have a final comment or statement you'd like to leave with our listening audience on building the possibilities of building a nation within a nation?
Yeah. So what I would say is this, that... Professor Lowe came up with very, very good examples of how African black nationalistic tendencies have failed. All right. But what he didn't propose was strategies and solutions. All right? We can create the world that we need for our future generations. If we do not, we leave ourselves open to all other ethnicities and groups to dominate us. After, once America falls, who's going to take their place? It may be Hispanics. It may be a red dawn with China, who needs more land and resources coming over here and dominating Black Americans. So, yes. Are there issues in creating this? Absolutely. But again, like I said, like I want to reiterate, we don't really have a choice. We have to be strong, just like we were strong through all the epochs of being, throughout American history, U.S. history, throughout colonialism, throughout imperialism. We have to be strong, and we have to figure this out.
Thank you.
And there are strategies and ways to which we can do that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mutor K. Flood, visiting professor of Bethune-Cookman. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
All right. Stay tuned. We have up next American Roots, and then later, the Classical Challenge. Good night, everybody.